Good morning and happy Mother's Day. This week, Verna and I had the just priceless privilege of being with Dan and Lindsay Miller to dedicate their little girl, Ellie Mae, to Jesus Christ. It was a wonderful time together. It didn't work to show a video this time, but the time just doing that was great. During that time, Dan's parents, Dan and Melinda Miller, were there. And Dan Sr. Prayed over this little girl, which was great. And also, Lindsay revealed that little Ellie is going to have a sibling come October. This was not a gender reveal party, so sorry, you're going to have to wait a while to find out whether it's a boy or a girl. We also just learned this week that the government of Pennsylvania has asked now that churches not have baptisms at church or at home. And although this was a dedication, not a baptism, it's a similar thing. And so we will need to avoid any kind of service like that for a little while yet. And hopefully that'll come back soon. Okay. For today's passage in Isaiah, it will help you to have a Bible with you. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version, the ESV. But of course, you may have another version together. Think of a child in a children's hospital with cancer, getting stuck with needles and going through treatments that make her sick, or that cause her to be isolated, or that in some other way are just confusing and painful. Now the parents come and say, I know you're going through a lot, but after you get out of here and you're feeling better, we're going to take you to Disney World. And even though that is a little ways off, that gives a kid comfort and something to look forward to. In a sense, that's what God is doing here in this passage today from chapter 61 of Isaiah. He's telling his people of the good that's in the future, even though they're going through so many difficult times right now. We're reading from Isaiah chapter 61, beginning with verse 10. You're probably aware that in ancient languages of that day, there were no chapter divisions or even verse divisions. And so really, the chapter ought to begin with Isaiah 61, verse 10. Going down through verse 7 of Isaiah 62. From Isaiah 61, verse 10. I greatly rejoice in the Lord, and my soul shall exalt in my God. For he has clothed me with garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness. As a bridegroom decks himself like a priest with a beautiful dress, and as a bride adorns herself with her jewels. For as the earth brings forth its sprouts, and as a garden causes what is sown to sprout up, so the Lord God will cause righteousness and praise to sprout up before all nations. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not be quiet until her righteousness goes forth as brightness and her salvation as a burning torch. The nations shall see your righteousness, and all the kings your glory, and you shall be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will give. You shall be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord, and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. You shall no more be termed forsaken, and your land shall no more be termed desolate, but you shall be called, My delight is in her, and your land shall be called married. For the Lord delights in you, and your land shall be married. For as a young man marries a young woman, so shall your sons marry you. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you. On your walls, O Jerusalem, I have set watchmen. All the day and all the night they shall never be silent. You who put the Lord in remembrance, take no rest, and give him no rest, until he establishes Jerusalem and makes it a praise in the earth. If nothing else is clear from this passage, it's that hugely great things are in store for God's people. Now, our passage is part of a larger section of Isaiah that goes from chapter 60 through chapter 62. Some people have entitled it something like The Glory of Zion or The Glorious Future of God's people, something like that, because great things are coming. great things are coming? Well, they better get here fast, because during Isaiah's time, it was anything but great things. For about 50 years, Israel had enjoyed relative peace from aggression from other countries. But in the year that King Uzziah died, in 740 BC, things began to turn. Isaiah saw, shortly after that, the rise of the Empire of Assyria far to the east, which was an enormous empire gobbling up states right and left. Isaiah was there when Assyria ate up the 10 northern tribes of Israel. Their southern border of the Assyrian Empire then came to within just a few miles of Jerusalem. And after they conquered the 10 northern tribes, Assyria began its ugly reach into the two southern tribes and began whittling away at the country of Judah until Jerusalem was just an island surrounded by her enemies. And had God not miraculously intervened during the kingship of Hezekiah, even Jerusalem would have been washed away. So now it was just an island in a sea of enemies. But good news was predicted by Isaiah. He predicted that Assyria would fall. But then he predicted after Assyria's fall, later, the Babylonian Empire would come and would actually crush Jerusalem and take its citizens into exile. But then Isaiah turned to picture a wonderful future for Israel after all these trials. He said in numerous places in his book that the Babylonian Empire would fall and that the people who had been sent away would return from exile, that God would show his mercy. Probably the most famous chapter in this regard is Isaiah chapter 40, where Jehovah is leading his people back from Babylon, and it says, "Make straight in the desert a highway for our God," as he leads the exiles home. "Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill made low." It means, since it was a rugged area, could you make sure that the valleys are filled up with dirt so that it's smooth, that the hills are carved down so that God has a clear highway for his people to follow him back to their homeland. It's a wonderful passage. And so much of Isaiah's book is about the glorious future of Jerusalem. And especially that's true of our chapters, chapters 60 to 62. For instance, let's look at a couple verses there. In chapter 60, verse 1, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you." Oh, that's good news. Or chapter 60, verse 14, "The sons of your oppressors will come bowing before you." That was wonderful news to people who were eaten alive, as it were, by the Assyrians. Chapter 61, verse 3, "There will be gladness instead of weeping." Or chapter 61, verse 6, "Instead of empires robbing Jerusalem," we read, quote, "You," that is the people of Jerusalem, "will feed on the wealth of nations, and in their riches you will boast." That is, their money is going to come to you rather than your money be taken by them. So, great things are in store. That's basically what this passage is saying. But you might be asking yourself as you read this, well, these prophecies, though, are they for me? And there are several reasons why you might think that. The first is that this passage, chapter 60 to 62, and particularly our passage, is addressed to Zion. Now, Zion is a hill in Israel. It's just a small, narrow, long hill. It's really measured in acres rather than in miles. I've had the priceless privilege of studying in Jerusalem, and I, along with fellow students, we just walked the length in a matter of minutes. The meaning of the word Zion is unsure. It could come from the word bald, because it's a place where there aren't any trees. And it could come from the word to defend, because it was certainly a fortress, a stone fort in the time of King David, and he had a hard time capturing it because it has valleys on each side, which made it quite steep and almost impregnable. Now, at one end of the little hill of Zion, God's temple was built, and together that little hill and that temple came to be known as Mount Zion. Over time, as the city grew, all of Jerusalem came to be known as Zion. And then, still later, the whole nation came to be known as Zion after that little hill. Now, chapters 60 to 62 are all to Zion. One of the ways we know that is that all the words "you" or "your," in these chapters are in the feminine. That is, they're addressed to Zion, considered as the daughter, the dearly loved daughter of God. So in chapter 60, verse 14, we read, "All who despise you will bow down at your feet and will call you the city of the Lord, Zion of the Holy One of Israel." Or in chapter 60, verse 2 and following, the speaker is sent, he says, quote, "to comfort those who grieve in Zion." That's who the book is to. Now, it's interesting. He's going to comfort people who, you remember what's happening in Isaiah's time, the Assyrians coming, and then later the Babylonians coming. Zion is receiving words of comfort about that. Or in chapter 62, verse 11, they address the, quote, "daughter of Zion." That's a phrase that's used a number of times in the Old Testament. It doesn't mean that Zion has a daughter. It means that Zion is a daughter. God likens her to a dearly loved daughter of his. And we read in 62:11, "Say to the daughter of Zion, see, your servant, your Savior comes. See, his reward is with him." So all these references to Zion in our chapters may make a person think, well, isn't this then to Old Testament Israel or to Jerusalem or to the Jewish people and not to me at all? And a second reason why you may think that these passages are not to you is because the promises tend to speak about ancient times, ancient places, ancient names, and ancient things. We read in these chapters 60 to 62 that the ancient cities are going to be rebuilt. We read in chapter 60, verse 6, that there are going to be herds of camels will cover your land. Isn't that a wonderful promise that you claim every single day when you have your devotions? Or we read in chapter 60, verse 7, flocks and rams will again be accepted as offerings on my altar, and I will adorn my glorious temple. There's going to be a temple in these promises. Well, we don't have a temple in Jerusalem now. And flocks and rams are going to be offered as sacrifices. God has forbidden us to offer sacrifices anymore because Jesus' sacrifices stopped that once for all. So is this really for us? Chapter 60, verse 18 says that the city will have walls and will have gates. We're going to have a city with walls and gates? And it says, it talks about ancient places, that camels are going to come from Midian. They're the ancient enemies of the Israelites from the desert. They don't exist as a tribe anymore. And that ships will come from Tarshish. Tarshish was in Spain. It as a place really doesn't exist anymore. And gold and incense will come from Sheba, it says. Sheba is where the Queen of Sheba came from, who visited Solomon from somewhere in the south, perhaps in Arabia, perhaps in northern Africa. We don't know. But these places are names that are not familiar now because the people who occupy them and their cultures and their names are gone. They've passed away. So are these passages really about us? What's the answer to that? I hope to convince you that these passages are very much for you. Let's take that second problem we spoke of, taking the problems in reverse order. The fact that this passage speaks about ancient times with ancient names and ancient things. The answer to this problem as to why these passages still apply to you is because prophecies in the Old Testament often, I would say, generally, usually, had what's come to be called a double fulfillment. That is, a fulfillment in ancient times, but also a fulfillment far off in the coming centuries, in another age, perhaps the age we live in, perhaps the eternal age. Let me give you several examples of that to show why this applies to you. You may recall a famous passage, Isaiah 7, where the prophet Isaiah went to King Ahaz to tell him that certain things are going to happen. And then the prophet says, God is going to give you a sign that these things will happen. In 7:14, here is the sign, quote, "The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel." And then in verse 16, "Before this child knows right from wrong, certain things will happen." Now that passage was fulfilled then in that time during the life of King Ahaz and the prophet Isaiah. When he says virgin will conceive, the word virgin can mean a woman who has never been with a man, but can also just be used of a young woman of childbearing age. And so the virgin, we learn as we read forward, was Isaiah's wife. he said, I went to my wife, she conceived, and we had a son, and he was given still another name. So that was a fulfillment right then. And yet, it was clearly fulfilled later, as Matthew brings out, in the Virgin Mary, 700 years later, in the person of Jesus Christ becoming Emmanuel. The lesson is this, that God uses ancient events to prefigure later, even greater events. He does this in the prophets all the time. Another example of God using ancient language and people and places and names and events to speak of future things that are going to happen comes from 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 12. Peter is talking about Old Testament prophets, and he says, "It was revealed to them," that is, these Old Testament prophets, which include Isaiah, "it was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you." The you that he's writing to are Christians in the first century. He says that the prophets were not serving themselves, that is, their own times primarily. Well, isn't this mysterious then, since all the prophecies are using language of camels and ancient countries and ancient cities and so forth? Well, it is mysterious. He goes on to say in 1 Peter that even angels long to look into these things. Another way that we know that God uses ancient things in the prophets to speak to future things, things perhaps in our lifetime, has to do with his predictions of the exile by the Babylonians of the Jews and their return 70 years later. Of course, 70 years, this actually happened in ancient times. They came back and they rebuilt the temple. And when God speaks in Isaiah and Jeremiah about the rebuilding of the temple, it's a glorious thing. And yet, when the temple was rebuilt, as I say, about 70 years later after the exile, the book of Ezra, chapter 3, verse 12, makes it clear that the people who were old enough to remember the former temple of Solomon back in the day and compare it with the new temple that was rebuilt during the lifetimes of Ezra and Nehemiah, it says that these people wept because it was so small compared to the former grandeur of Solomon's temple. And yet when the predictions are made of the rebuilding of the temple, it's a grand and glorious thing where God's glory is going to shine from his temple. What's going on? And later, when Herod's temple was built during the time of Jesus, well, in AD 70, about 40 years after Jesus' death, that temple was totally leveled and destroyed by the Romans. In other words, none of the fulfillments of the temple being rebuilt ever matched the glory of the prophecies of its rebuilding. These rebuildings were made to whet the appetite for a far greater rebuilding. And so, ever since Jesus' time, Christians in the main have read Isaiah and other prophets in this manner, that Isaiah and the prophets use the sights and the sounds and the pictures of their own day, literal return of exiles to a literal Jerusalem, to describe the future work of the Messiah in rescuing people from their exile and slavery into sin and darkness, to bring them home to God's temple where they would worship him acceptably. This is remarkable. And Isaiah, and I suspect the other prophets, almost certainly did not grasp that the Messiah's coming and doing these greater things that were prefigured. They probably didn't grasp that the Messiah would come in two stages. That was the great mystery that people didn't get, that he would come first time to suffer and that he would reign, not externally, but reign in people's hearts and enable them to live righteous lives and forgive their sins and to cause them to spread his gospel, thus his kingdom, all across the world through the Christian church. And only later, at a second time, would Jesus actually come bodily to judge his enemies and to bring heaven itself down eternally, finally, to earth. So that's the first problem, that when it speaks of ancient things are used as pictorial in the Bible of greater spiritual things in the future, and that means these things are written for you. Now, to the first problem we mentioned with thinking the passage is yours, that is, that it's addressed to Zion. The New Testament clearly uses the term Zion for the Christian church. We see this in a number of places. Take First Peter again, chapter 2, starting with verse 5. There, the Apostle Peter is writing to believers, and he calls them a temple of living stones. The reason he uses that odd language is because he says that we're being built together into a spiritual house. The idea of a house there is a temple. But it's not a literal temple. It's a spiritual temple. And you are a stone, and the member next to you is a stone, and I'm a stone, and the other members are stones. And together, we build a temple. That is a place where God meets people, the Christian church. And it says that Jesus Christ is the cornerstone of this temple. That is, Jesus started his church. And then remarkably, he adds us to this temple that he in us and with us build where God the Father is worshiped. And notice what this temple that we all build together in ourselves is called. First Peter 2, there, Peter quotes Isaiah 28 when he says, "This is what the sovereign Lord says. See, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation." The idea is that the readers are probably just thinking of literal earthly Zion, and God is thinking of something far greater in the future. The idea is that in Jerusalem, that is in Zion, people meet God. They meet him especially in the temple. And when Jesus cleared the temple in John chapter 2, they said, "By what authority do you clear this temple?" And Jesus says, "Destroy this temple, and I will rebuild it in 3 days." And by this, he meant the temple of his body. So we are joined to Jesus Christ, God's final temple, and we become the final temple. So in summary then, Jesus is the cornerstone of the temple. We as living stones are joined to him, and together he and we are called Zion. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 6. There's another way in which we know that the term Zion doesn't just apply to Old Testament Israelites, and it comes from Hebrews chapter 12, starting with verse 22. He's talking to the Hebrews, who are believers now, and he's telling them that even though their lives are hard with suffering right now, he's reminding them of the glory that they really have, even though they only approach it by faith now. He says, "You Christians have come to Mount Zion." Really? I would say the majority of our congregation has never visited Israel. A few of us have been fortunate enough to either take a vacation there or study there. Well, how is it that you have never been there? How is it that you have come to Mount Zion? Well, he explains. "You have come," he says, "to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God." Oh, that's a head scratcher. Does that mean that Zion is in heaven? Does it mean that it's a city? Does it mean that it's a place? Well, he goes on to describe what he means. "You have come to Mount Zion. You have come to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly." And then he goes on and says, "You have come to," and all these are parts of Zion, "you have come to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven." You probably know that in ancient times, the firstborn son got the far greater part of the inheritance. And in the Christian church, God calls all of us firstborn sons because we all receive a marvelous inheritance. Now think about this now. He says, "You've come to Zion." I mean by that, you've come to the heavenly Jerusalem. I mean by that, you come to thousands and thousands of angels. I mean by that, you have come to the firstborn, church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. In other words, then he goes on to say what that means. You have come to the spirits of righteous men made perfect. That is, of Christians who have died and whose souls are now in heaven. You have come to them. And finally, he says, you have come to Jesus. In all these descriptions, he's not talking about a place. He's talking about persons. Jesus, the angelic beings, Christians who have died, believers from the Old Testament who have died, all of them together constitute the real Zion, the real Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem that Christians are a part of. And thus Isaiah's passages are to you. And finally, is that proof of this is from Revelation chapter 21, verse 2. We tend to think of a literal city when we think of the New Jerusalem, but here's what he says in Revelation 21, 2, speaking of the end of time and heaven and so forth. I, John, saw the holy city. Oh, heaven has a city. The New Jerusalem. Oh, okay, the heaven is a Jerusalem, but higher and better than the earthly Jerusalem. But he explains, I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. Folks, we are the New Jerusalem. We are the holy city. We are the living stones built into a temple, built into Zion, the place where God dwells in the middle of us because we have the cornerstone of Jesus Christ, who has made us holy by his blood and through his spirit. Zion, in Isaiah and everywhere else in the Old Testament prophets, may speak firstly to literal Zion that will be rebuilt after 70 years. But Zion is far greater than that. It is primarily all of God's people who ever lived. From the Old Testament people who look forward to the coming of the Messiah, today to the Christian church of every century, of every nation, tribe, tongue, and language. Well, I realize that we took all our time here today to just introduce this passage to give us a background. But today, just before we close then, let's read verse 1 to 3 of chapter 62 again through the eyes that we've gotten through thinking about these things and see if it doesn't make the passage come alive some. We don't know yet who in verse 1 the I is who's speaking. We'll look into that next week. But listen to the future of your church. I don't mean just Brick Lane. I mean the universal church of Jesus Christ that you are part of. Listen to your future. Isaiah 62, 1. For Zion's sake, I will not keep quiet. And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not be silent until her righteousness goes forth as brightness and her salvation as a burning torch. The nations will see your righteousness and all kings will see your glory and you shall be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will give. You shall be a crown of beauty in the hand of Jehovah, and you will be a royal diadem in the hand of your God. So as I say, next week we'll look at these verses in detail. But for now, think about this. You are a part of something far bigger than yourself. You are a part of a drama, a story far bigger than the one that you yourself are writing for yourself. While you shelter at home, there is someone who stays awake at night, who will not sleep, who will not stand down until, together with all past and present and future believers, he sees to it that you shine like the sun to the whole world. And he sees that you are a beautiful thing in the hand of God. May God give you a sense of that this week. And could I request that our congregation reads this week Isaiah chapters 60, 61, 62, so when we come together next week, these things will be even more clear to our eyes. Let me give you a benediction that I read from Dale Ralph Davis that I thought was so appropriate for us. Congregation of the Lord Jesus Christ. In all your darkness and troubles, remember what you are and have. You have been loved with an everlasting love. You are supported by everlasting arms. You are recipients of everlasting life and heirs of an everlasting kingdom, all sealed and made sure by the blood of an everlasting covenant. Amen.